Okay, so I'm going to explore an analogy between Russell's paradox on the one hand and Cantor's theorem on the other. So first, let's say that some things form a set if there is a set with exactly those things as its members. Then Russell's paradox says that there are some things that aren't the members of a set, namely the sets that aren't members of themselves. Analogously, say that some things are counted if there is a function defined on the natural numbers with those things in its range. Cantor's theorem then tells us that there are some things that aren't counted, namely the sets of natural numbers. So there's sort of an analogy there. It's an inexistence argument. The analogy is sort of like extended through the way these things are proved. There's something quite similar about the arguments here. So in the case of Russell's paradox, you consider the set of those, the alleged set of things that aren't members of themselves, and then consider whether or not it's a member of itself and find that it is, if and only if it is not. The case of Cantor's theorem is slightly more sort of convoluted, but you assume that there's a function which assigns some integer to every set of integers, and then find that the integer assigned to the set of those integers that aren't in the set they're assigned is similarly a member of itself, if and only if it isn't, and conclude that there was no such function to begin with. And then, you know, there's certain limiting cases where Cantor's theorem and Russell's paradox kind of coincide. They're very kind of similar. This isn't that special. A lot of things kind of have this form, but, you know, it's a thing. Now, slightly more to develop this analogy in slightly more detail, there's at least a possibility, one could argue, that these both kind of have a paradoxical flavor about them. Now, in the Russell paradox, this is kind of, well, so first of all, to see the paradoxical flavor, we'll assume that this principle is true, which I'll call necessitism. It says, roughly, if P is possible, then P is true for any mathematical proposition P. This is often taken to be a kind of distinctive feature of mathematical propositions. So like, if there could have been such a set, then there in fact is one. And given that, Russell's paradox implies that there are some things that just can't form a set. And there are, you know, various people who found this to be a strange result. Like, what is it about these things that stops them from being the members of a set? Something like that. Similarly, in the case of Cantor's theorem, we get that there are some things that can't be counted, that is to say, are uncountable. And now, this might, to us all today, seems like completely normal and standard, and we're totally all very used to it. But there was a time when people thought that the idea of there being different sizes of infinity was just, you know, obviously false or perhaps even incoherent. And so, you know, with the right spectacles on, you might find that there's a paradoxical nature for Cantor's theorem too. I think that really the question of whether or not we view these things as paradoxical, either of them, is really a kind of uninteresting, well, at least a sociological question, and not really, there's not really a deep fact there. But what I do want to suggest is that given the close analogy between these things, we might think about what happens when we extend the kind of solutions that have been proposed for Russell's paradox in the literature to ones analogous for Cantor's theorem. So, in recent times, people have become interested in modal solutions to the Russell paradox, which involve denying this necessitist principle and accepting that any things can be the members of a set. So given that you have this argument which says there are some things which aren't the members of a set, this will then tell you that, well, okay, still they can. But then the reasoning of Russell's paradox implies that, you know, in a situation where they do, there are still some things that don't form a set. Right, but then you can apply this again and find that they can, and you keep going indefinitely. And the general picture is that the universe of sets is indefinitely extensible. You can keep adding more and more into the domain. Analogously, a modal solution to Cantor's theorem would deny this and say that any things of which there's at least one can be in the domain, the range of a function on the natural numbers. So, you know, again, similarly, this guy is going to tell us that there are some things, well, you know, the non-modal version is going to tell us there are always some things which are not in the range of a function defined on the natural numbers. But then this guy comes along and says, aha, they possibly are, they can be in the range. And then in the new situation where those things are in the range of, if let's say they were the sets of natural numbers. In a new situation where the sets of natural numbers are in the range of such a function, they're no longer all the sets of natural numbers. But you can iterate this. And on the picture that is associated with this, we'll find that not only do we have indefinite extensibility for the sets, but also indefinite extensibility for the sets of natural numbers. That's the picture I'm going to explore, and all that remains is the details. So I'm going to start by explaining the one version of a modal solution for Russell's paradox, and then generalize it to Cantor's theorem. Okay, so start off with a kind of tension in the iterative concept of set. So when one is introduced to sort of, you know, axioms of ZFC and what's their motivation, you often hear this kind of story about set construction process, right? So it's like, to be a set is to be the sort of thing you'd form if, starting with some things, you first form all possible sets of those things, then you form all possible sets of those, and then you keep going. And then once you've done that infinitely many times, you form a set of all of those guys, and you just keep going for as long as is possible. And there's a kind of modal and procedural flavor to this description, right? On the other hand, once you actually start doing axiomatic set theory, it's just a straightforward first-order theory, and this talk of procedure is sort of cashed out in flattened first-order terms. So to be a set is just to belong to one of these ranks, and they are all out there, and there's nothing funny with possibility or constructions going on. Now, you could take this kind of mismatch in two ways. One way, which probably is the standard way to take it, is just to say, we've found a great way of making this vague procedural modal talk precise, or something like that. On the other hand, you could say, well, maybe the language that we're using to formulate the theory is not sort of expressive enough to get at the kind of real core of the iterative concept of set, and maybe we should consider expanding it. Now, some potentially weak evidence for this latter view is, well, so take this on the standard view, we have this cumulative hierarchy which contains all the sets there ever could be. And one could say, well, okay, let's take those and make a new definition. We'll call something a superset of rank 0 if it was one of those. And then we'll call it a superset of rank alpha plus 1 if it is a superset of things of rank alpha. And, you know, do the usual definition from there. And then we'll have this new, you know, we'll have sets and we'll have supersets or classes or whatever you want to call them. We could keep doing this indefinitely. And you might think, well, aren't these things just more sets than the things we started out with? They sure look a lot like them. And so there seems to be some kind of inherent tension in the idea that there is this guy V which has all the sets there ever could be. So that's some, and this might, you might think, okay, well, let's now look at formalizing this idea in a modal language and see if we can't get rid of this sort of tension. And thoughts of this kind have led people to do that. So Charles Parsons, Øystein Lindeboe, James Studd, and others. So I'm briefly going to sketch Lindeboe's theory, which will generalize nicely to the case of Cantor's theorem. Actually, incidentally, any of the others would do just as well. It's just that I chose Lindeboe. So the theory, which I'm going to call L for obvious reasons, is in a language with not only modal operators, but also plural variables. So we're going to be able to say things like, you know, this or that is possible or necessary, but also we'll be able to talk about things plurally, not just individual things. Again, this is inessential. Other theories don't do it that way. We'll also have this term-forming operator, which attaches to a plural term to produce a singular term, intuitively the set of the x-sexes, you know, the set of those things. And this guy is going to mean x is one of the xx. So the intuitive idea is to axiomatize the kind of informal iterative conception idea directly using this vocabulary. A modal operator will mean phi, so diamond phi or possibly phi will mean phi can be made true by adding enough sets. The intuitive possible worlds model theory is just that a possible world is a rank of the cumulative hierarchy, and one rank accesses another, or is possible relative to another if it's later than, or you know, no earlier than the other. So for a simple picture, we might have a possible world with a singular domain, some V alpha, and a plural domain, the next rank up. And then an accessible world will just be a guy on top, some bigger beta. Okay, so how are we going to formalize this theory? Well, we'll have a plural logic, which will have impredicative plural comprehension. It will have, so plurals will be extensionally individuated and rigidly. That means some things are the things they are because they have exactly the constituents they do in all situations, right? So Tom, Dick, and Harry are those guys just because all possible worlds, they comprise only Tom, Dick, and Harry. We'll also have a version of the axiom of choice for plurality. So it'll say roughly if you have some non-empty sets, then there are some things that comprise one element of each. For the modal logic, we'll have the logic S4.2 with a converse Barkhausen formula and the necessity of distinctness. So these are all, the axioms of S4.2 are all straightforwardly justifiable in terms of the model theory I just described for you. So for instance, the reflexivity axiom is true because if something's already true, then you can make it true by adding sets. You don't need to do anything, for example. The rule of necessitation is the only slightly tricky one here. That's a kind of soundness sort of principle, right? If it's provable from the rest, all of the axioms collectively that something holds, then it's going to be true no matter what sets you introduce. And that's only going to hold if all the axioms collectively sort of don't lead you astray. But they don't. Converse Barkhausen just means you don't lose anything. So whenever you introduce a set, it stays there forever. Distinctness is given. Also, we'll have foundation. So no matter what sets you introduce for any set, you'll never introduce one that shares members with all of its members. And that follows just from the well-orderedness of the stages. This one is slightly more substantial. It says, no matter what sets you introduce, given any set, you can always introduce a further set containing those things as its members. Okay. As it stands, these axioms already suffice to do a bit of set theory, but they have a Kripke model whose possible worlds are exactly the Vn's for finite n, so they don't prove that it's possible that there are any infinite sets. To get around this, we stick in something like the axiom of affinity. This is deviating slightly from Lillebeau's presentation. So I'm going to call this a completability axiom. What this means is, if you go far enough up, if you introduce enough sets, eventually there will be some things such that no matter what sets you introduce, those things are exactly the hereditarily finite sets. You will never introduce a new one. So the idea is if you keep going long enough, you keep introducing things, eventually you'll have introduced all the hereditarily finite sets you could introduce. And in general, if I take out HF and put some other condition, then I'll have completability for that condition too. Also, obviously, this needs this to be definable, but it will be definable. Okay. But of course, then we're gonna run into similar problems again, right? So now that we've got this in the picture, we know that we can find all the possible hereditarily finite sets, and then using this guy, we can prove that a lot of particular infinite sets exist. We can prove that all the set of natural numbers exists and the set of even numbers, but it doesn't follow from these axioms that you can form all the possible sets of hereditarily finite sets at a single world, right? So you can put any particular one in a world, but you can't get all of them together necessarily. That is ensured by another completeness axiom. So this guy is just a parameter, but it's basically the same. It says, given any arbitrary thing, eventually, if you go on long enough, you can produce all its subsets. And so with these guys, you'll be guaranteed at least roughly up to V omega plus omega in the kind of potential hierarchy. So this guy now says, essentially, you can definitely get at least up to V omega plus omega, but you won't necessarily get beyond. The next axiom just is a kind of replacement sort of deal that ensures you can get beyond. So these are the axioms I'm for Linnabo's theory, let's see what we can say about them. So one point is that they are consistent because they have a really easy Kripke model whose wilds are the V alphas. The next point, which we'll get to your question, is that they interpret all of ZFC. So first of all, we need a definition. I'll call it the diamond potentialist translation because we'll consider other ones later for different modal operators. Roughly, the idea is take any formula in the first order language of set theory, then its diamond potentialist translation, which I'll call phi diamond, is the result of just sticking a box in front of every universal quantifier and a diamond in front of every existential quantifier. Then we can prove that ZFC proves phi if and only if L proves phi of diamond. So you'll get transfinite induction in its diamonded form and all the other stuff you get in ZFC this way. And for a quick proof sketch, the first thing you need to show, which is essentially routine, is that if you have, if gamma derives phi in ordinary classical logic, then gamma diamond derives phi diamond in S4.2. It's called the mirroring theorem. It means that you don't have to, anything you can classically derive from some hypotheses, if you sort of potentialize all of the premises, you'll be able to derive the potentialization of the conclusion. And given that, you don't have to worry about derivability. You now just have to derive the translations of the axioms. And that's fairly straightforward. So for instance, if you want to get the translation of the power set axiom, which just says necessarily for any x, it's possible there is a y that's the set of all its subsets, we just say take any given set. Then by this guy, we can find all of its subsets plurally. And then by this guy, we can prove that set exists. And then we've just done the power set axiom. Similarly for the other axioms. This guy is just literally the potentialist translation of the replacement schema. So we definitely have replacement. Okay, so we have this theory, which is consistent. It has all the mathematical power of ordinary set theory under this potentialist translation. And it has a nice, simple motivation in the iterative conception of set. It also proves that any possible things are at least possibly the elements of a set. So there's no special things that can't be the members of a set. So at the very least, I think this puts pressure on the idea that the iterative conception commits us somehow to the ideal standard set theory, commits us to the idea that there are some special things that can't be the members of a set. Maybe more could be argued in favor of this, but that's the minimal thing that I think is obvious. All right, now I'm going to do the extension to Cantor's theorem, which is really the kind of meat. I just gave you a theory on which any possible things at least possibly form a set, and showed how to recover standard mathematics under the potentialist translation. Now I'm going to generalize that theory to do the same thing for Cantor's theorem and uncountability. So I showed the resulting theory, which I call M, can also interpret standard set theory under a similar potentialist translation. In the case of L and the Russell's paradox, I'm just going to address a possible disanalogy about the paradoxical nature of these of Cantor's theorem. So in the case of L and Russell's paradox, we had this problem regarding all the possible sets that motivated us to move to the modal setting. And it might not be obvious that Cantor's theorem has a similar thing. It seems perfectly fine for there to be uncountably many things, right? But there's something in the vicinity here which, although it's not immediately obvious what the relevance is, turns out to be intimately related to this problem. And that is that the practice of forcing does pose an apparent problem for the cumulative hierarchy account, the standard iterative conception picture, for width as opposed to height. And I think following it through has some consequences for what we think about uncountability. So in ordinary set theoretic mathematics, there's increasingly the invocation of lots of V-like structures which are connected to one another by via relations like being a forcing ground, being a forcing extension. And a nice example of this is from recent work with Victoria and Ralf Schindler about virtual large cardinals, where these are cardinals which are kind of, well, these are, you know, interesting objects which are defined by their behavior in generic extensions, right? So like, in order to even understand the notion, you have to take the idea of a generic extension seriously. And, you know, this sort of seems to suggest that we should really be taking seriously the idea that, you know, given any kind of candidate universe, you can always force it, right? You can always force over it to extend to add new sets to an already given rank. And I think an open problem in the philosophy of set theory, which I think Leon was addressing in the previous talk, is to try and somehow explain why forcing is a natural thing to do in set theory, given the sort of some kind of conceptual picture of what sets are like. I think that, and Hamkins also obviously is somebody who's keen on working out a solution here. And what I'm going to do now is suggest this theory M, which I'll develop, offers a kind of modal solution to this, and that this according to which forcing is always possible, right? No matter what situation you're in, and it will yield as a consequence then the countability of all things. So the idea is a generalization of the ordinary iterative conception picture. So on the standard iterative conception, you have this one kind of operation you can do: stick in some new sets on the top. But the generalization will allow you at any given stage to do one of, well, infinitely many things. You can either add some new things on the top, or you can force outwards. You can add new sets to already given ranks. The theory I'm going to give is going to axiomatize this intuitive picture in modal terms. So back to our crude picture. Here's your possible world, your average set theoretic situation. You can still do this. And go up to a new accessible world, a bit higher up. But you can also do this. And I mean like this to be like, this is not just a countable model or anything. This is supposed to be just, you know, how things are at any given stage. And then you can also go up. And going up will turn out to be the same as going out. You know, it'll commute in the right way. But that's the general picture of sort of how the generalized iterative conception will unfold. Yeah. So it's going to be useful in axiomatizing this to use a multimodal plural language. So we'll have one modal operator, which says roughly, I call it vertically possible. Phi can be made true by adding sets on the top. Diamond H will mean phi can be made true by adding sets on the side, or horizontal extension. And this guy is just going to be what you can make true by arbitrary iterations of either domain expansion technique. So you can go either way. And what are the axioms? Well, for the plural logic, we'll have the same thing we had before. For the modal logic, we'll have the same thing we had before, but this time for each of the modalities. So they're all separately said to have those conditions. We'll also have this weakening axiom, which says if it's vertically possible, then it's possible simpliciter. And similarly, if it's horizontally possible, it's possible simpliciter, which is kind of obviously justified by what the definitions were. And then we'll have vertical extendability this time, which means given any things, you can go up to introduce a set with those things as its members. And we'll have vertical, well, this is just really normal completability for the hereditarily finite sets, because by weakening, this can be replaced by an ordinary diamond, but I'll put it that way for technical reasons. So this is just basically the axiom of infinity. But then the interesting one This one has, our completability axiom for subsets has now changed slightly. Because now, remember before, completability said if you go up far enough, you'll produce all the subsets you could ever produce of a given set, right? But if we take this V away here, which would be the natural analog of that in this setting, we'll say the same thing, but then we'll rule out the possibility of forcing to add new subsets of the set, right? So this will say, with the box just like this, this will say you either going up or out, you can't add new subsets. So we won't want that, because we're always going to want to be able to go out to add new subsets. So we only assert completability for the vertical modality. So that means no matter how far you, you can always go up far enough such that you've introduced all the subsets you will ever introduce by going up, right? But not necessarily by going out. And then we'll also have this guy, horizontal extendability, which, so this is an abbreviation for X as a partial order, and this is an abbreviation of Y as generic for X. And this says that necessarily given any partial order, it's horizontally possible that there is a generic filter for that order. So this asserts the sort of straightforward possibility of forcing over any partial order that you care to choose. And then we'll also have replacement on all of the modalities. So this guy is consistent too. I will sketch the proof, but obviously not go into detail. So let M be a countable transitive model for ZFC with a proper class of inaccessibles from the point of view of M. And let M be its generic multiverse, the blackboard M. Then our Kripke model is going to have, as its possible worlds, those V alpha in N from the generic multiverse over M, which satisfy ZFC. You don't need, you just need each of them to be good enough to force over. I mean, ZFC is overkill, but we can take it. Now, one of these guys is going to vertically access another if they come from the same universe in the multiverse, and the rank of one is no greater than the rank of the other. No less than the rank of the other. There'll be horizontal accessibility if the ranks are the same, but one is a forcing extension of the other. Right? So that's very similar to the picture that I gave you on the previous slide. And then the accessibility for the most general modality is just simply the substructure relation. And then it is fairly straightforward to show that this satisfies all the axioms. I mean, some things are totally easy. Like, for instance, horizontal extendability is obvious because, you know, given any possible world, we can, and given any partial order, we can find a structure in the generic multiverse which, you know, forces with a generic filter over that partial order. Some things are less obvious, like, for instance, the fact that S4.2 holds for the general accessibility relation. Not totally clear, but it is true. It's actually a result of Linnabo and Hamkins. Do you still have a question, or was that your question? Okay, yeah. M also interprets ZFC basically because I built it so that it would. If we just pay attention to the diamond V modality, so we just think about box Vs and diamond Vs, then it's very easy to see that that every axiom of L, Linnabo's theory, is true under that interpretation. So then we get all of ZFC for just looking at the vertical modality. Intuitively, the thought is, given any situation, if you just introduce sets on top and never introduce anything on the side and go on indefinitely, in the limit, you'll make all ZFC true. You can do all the ordinary set theoretic constructions you like. The constructions of standard set theory are possible given using the vertical modality starting at any world. But if we think, so that's just with the vertical modality. Now if we broaden our horizons to the full modality, things will start to look different. So M interprets, it's easy to see that M interprets ZFC without power set under the full potentialist translation. And that's just basically because by the same reasoning for Linnabo's theory L, we have everything except for the completability of subsets, so we get that easily. But we also have, we also have that M proves necessarily for any X, if it's not empty, then it's possible that there is a function defined on the natural numbers with those guys in its range. Oh, I didn't change it. This should be an X, a single X. So necessarily for any non-empty set, that set is possibly in the range of a function defined on the natural numbers. And the argument is, I mean, intuitively, I hope it's clear, but the argument is a little bit finicky. So you can show that for a bounded formula phi, a delta zero formula, it's equivalent to its own potentialist translation in M. It uses S4.2 in the converse Barkan. It's a fairly easy induction. And given any non-empty set in any possible world, so to speak, you can use the vertical translation of set theory to prove that the partial order of finite partial functions on that set exists, ordered by reverse inclusion. And then that, yeah, that's just a partial order. So we can use our horizontal extendability axiom to prove that it's horizontally possible for there to be a generic filter for that order. But that claim is equivalent by a bounded formula to there being a function from the natural numbers on the, onto those things. So we'll have phi diamond of that claim, and then we'll have phi of that claim by the top thing. So we get the result that it's possible that there's a function defined on the natural numbers with that set in its range. And so this, but this is the potentialist translation of all sets are countable. So we get that M interprets under the full potentialist translation ZFC minus power set together with all sets are countable. And so what's going on here is we have in the full theory that kind of any set you care to name can be in the range of a function defined on the natural numbers. But if you just ignore the contributions of the horizontal modality and just go up, right, just use the vertical one, then you can get the appearance of all of these transfinite cardinals you'd proved to exist in ordinary set theory, right? So it's kind of, I'll talk more about what the kind of interpretation of that is. Do you have a question? Quick sketch of what this says about the continuum. So M also proves by pretty much the same reasoning that it's necessarily possible for the continuum to exist and also to have any cardinality you care to name, right? Just using basically the same argument as I gave for the countability of any set. So from the point of view of the theory, it's completely indeterminate. It's totally fluid what the cardinality of the continuum is. And the explanation for this is that whenever you have something which seems to be the continuum, it's only kind of locally the continuum. You can always go on to prove that there is a real number outside of that set, right? So the continuum just doesn't really exist in the last potentialist analysis. So it gives you something of an explanation for why the CH is so problematic. That's pretty much what I just said. Another consequence of this is that the sets of natural numbers on this account are indefinitely extensible, because given any sets of natural numbers, you can always force make them countable, and in that situation, there will be new sets of natural numbers by easy arguments. Okay, so let me summarize. Although this theory has the mathematical power of standard set theory, it proves that all things are countable. From the point of view of it, whenever you have something which seems to be a cardinal bigger than omega, that's only because you're ignoring certain functions that possibly exist that would show that it is not uncountable. The theory admits the natural motivation in this generalization of the iterative conception that sort of makes reasonable sense of the practice of forcing. And my tentative conclusion from this, the kind of weakest thing I would put on the line, is that those who think standard set theory unequivocally shows there are different infinite cardinalities, much like those who think that standard set theory unequivocally shows there are some things which can't be the members of a set, have a problem here. Why can't we think of Cantor's theorem in the way I've just described it as reflecting a kind of inherent kind of poverty of possible worlds? There's always functions missing from the domain. And this idea was first put in my head by Toby in a paper called Naive Infinitism. That's why the theory was called M. That's it. Thanks for listening.